Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you all for coming this morning. My name is Justin Kiggins, pronouns are he, him, I think I've seen most of you, but I'm a neuroscientist by training, spent many years working with animals and birds, studying their brains, and super excited to chat with you all today about barn owls. And in particular, to talk about some of the strategies that barn owls use to map the world around them and to be able to find things in their environment. Very good? Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. So over the past week, for those of you who've been coming, we've chatted about locusts and their transformations and some of the behavior and neuroscience that mediates their transformations. We talked about monarchs and in particular how they sense things in the sky that we don't sense necessarily, except through technological means, in order to support their southward migration. Today we're going to be talking about barn owls. One of the things that I really like about this talk and about barn owls is that a lot of what we'll talk about today is actually they share a lot with humans in terms of how they localize things that are in their environment. Their brains, their bodies are highly specialized and highly specialized through evolutionary pressures, such that they are really super. They almost have a superpower with their hearing, which we'll get into soon. And then finally, tomorrow we'll be chatting about songbirds and their songs. So our creature of the day is the common barn owl. Barn owls are present on 6 of the 7 continents of the world. They spread throughout. They can be found in the Americas, in Asia, Europe, South America, Australia, around the entire world. They are, for any of you, certainly any of you in the Midwest, if you're on farmland or have a farm, might be familiar with them. I mean, they in English we call them barn owls because they'll find their make homes in barns. And this is one thing that I there's a lovely video that we're going to play that I think really just helps to show what incredible hunters these guys are. So let's forgot to check the audio, so let's see if this works.
Cold weather and a blanket of snow have left us short of food.
Can y'all hear that okay?
Yeah.
Up a little bit?
I think if you adjust it on your computer.
Oh, right. I forgot there's a... That's a That's just about the max. Let's see how that goes, though.
So she's been forced to hunt in the day. And now she's got competition. A kestrel. It's one of the downsides of hunting during the daylight hours. And even worse, the snow means she can't see her prey. So how do you find your food when it's hiding out of sight? Hunger forces the kestrel to take a chance.
Oh,
But his razor-sharp eyesight isn't enough in these conditions. Luckily for the barn owl, she has another superpower in her armory. Flying blind won't stop her eating. Because although she can't see it, she can hear her prey, even under the snow. The kestrel simply doesn't have what it takes. So how does an owl's extraordinary hearing work?
So, yeah, so it's pretty incredible. So, our barn owls, and many owls for that matter, but barn owls are some of the ones that have been studied the most extensively, have this incredible ability to hear, and just an incredible level of precision that they can bring to bear on finding individual sounds that they're hunting. So what I'd like to open up and ask, as you think about that owl up in the flying over top of the snow, what information might she have had available to her in order to tell and judge where a sound is coming from?
Quality of the sound, like, I guess, well, what it sounds like, though, but like, I don't know, how muffled it is, just the stuff about it.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of like information content in the sound itself and the pattern of that waveform, yeah. That would probably help her to identify, is this a mouse, is this something that I'm hunting, or is that a snake, something I don't want? I don't know if snakes are probably not going around under snow, but yeah. Yeah.
This isn't an answer to your question, but what was the other bird?
The other bird was a kestrel.
A kestrel.
Yeah.
K-E-S-T-R-E-L. Thank you.
They're really pretty. Yeah.
I'm guessing the shape of the head and the ear in particular funnels that sound and helps it to triangulate.
Yeah, yeah. So there's some... What do you mean by triangulate?
Pinpoint where the sound is specifically coming from. Not just the sound, but locating the source of that sound.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where it was and where it's going to.
Yeah, where it was and where it's going to. Yeah. So triangulation is a... triangulation is something that we can use in lots of different contexts. So a lot of like radar systems rely on triangulation. So if you have a single source, like a single point, and if I might be able to send out a sonar ping, and I hear something back, that really only tells me how far away that thing is. But if I have two sources or two things that are picking up that ping, then I can do a calculation and I can say, okay, well, the thing that I was listening for is this far away from my one receiver and this far away from my other receiver. And that lets you kind of draw a triangle and zero in on where that is. And this kind of triangulation is ubiquitous in creatures like ourselves that have two ears. And we use our two ears and the information from our two ears to be able to do this type of triangulation. So when we hear a sound off to our right, we get a slightly different signal that comes into our right ear versus our left ear. When it's a sound off to our left, we get a different signal that comes into our left ear versus our right ear. And then when things are in front of us, those changes might be more subtle, but are still different. And so when we break this down and we think about triangulation, when we look throughout the animal kingdom, there's fundamentally two, So there's a couple of, so triangulation really helps with kind of a left-right. You know, it lets you know whether to go left or right. There's also a level of localization that Owl needed to do, which is also kind of up and down, right? Which is like, do I need to go up or down? Like, where is this, you know, this thing that I'm after? And if you pay close attention to, you know, one of the things I think is remarkable about these owls is that as she goes in for the... So if you watch as she goes in for the hunt, and watch her head in particular, as she goes in and makes her final dive. So she really focuses, her head is forward. She's almost craning out her neck as she dives in very closely. So she's zeroing in on that sound as she's going in and doing that full dive. So there's two kind of key challenges that she's faced with. Do I turn left or right? Or do I, you know, adjust up and down? And she's having to make these decisions as she's going in on this dive and adjust accordingly. And so we're gonna kind of walk through like what some of the cues are that are available to her. One of the main major cues that are available to owls and for ourselves with respect to kind of localizing sources on the left and right is timing. So if we imagine this is like a top-down view of a cartoon human head, and if you imagine a speaker over here that's, you know, playing some music or playing somebody's voice, somebody talking, we can imagine what's drawn right here is kind of a sketch, a schematic of the sound pressure of the sound wave that might be arriving at the left ear and the right ear. And what's being portrayed here is that that the left ear is closer to the speaker than the right ear. The right ear is closer than the left ear. And so the right ear gets the sound wave before the left ear does. So if we can make some, so through some judgment of the differences in timing, that can give us some information about which of the two, where the sound is relative to facing forward. The other cue is actually kind of pure volume. So the closer ear is also going to be louder because it's closer. Sound waves as they travel through air, the amount of energy, if I have a sound wave that's coming from, you know, one particular point, it leaves that point with a certain amount of energy. As that sound wave dissipates, each concentric circle or a sphere out has the same amount of energy as the sphere before it. So the total amount of energy that you get, it dissipates because the energy coming from my voice has spread out throughout the entire room. So by the time my voice gets to you, that energy has dissipated significantly. So between that energy dissipation, as well as something of like a shadowing effect, you end up with major level differences. So the head itself sort of acts as an acoustic shadow that blocks sound going to the ear opposite of a sound source. And so that also gives us a volume difference. So if we step back to this timing example though, you know, what the owl cares about isn't the level difference between the two ears, but what they want to know is what's that angle? Like what's the angle, how far do I need to turn to find that? And it turns out that some fairly simple math can drill down and you can calculate for any given angle exactly what the expected time difference should be. Sound travels at a certain speed, and so for any angle, you can do some trigonometry, and you can calculate an approximation of what that time difference should be. So if I can get the time difference, and if I can calculate the time difference, then that lets me pretty reliably calculate that angle. When we talk about, so with the speed of sound, the time difference between, we're sitting here talking, you're not perceiving any delay between seeing my lips move and the sound that comes to your ears. There is a very slight delay there, right? Like light travels faster than sound. But especially in like close contacts, sound travels quite fast. The time difference that you might be hearing, most everybody's kind of facing me, right? But the time difference that you might get between your two ears is quite small. In the case of an owl, it comes down to basically a microsecond, like 1/1000th of a second is the time difference between the two ears. So it's an incredibly short amount of time. In this context, neurons are incredibly slow. So if you get if I poke your toe, it takes several milliseconds for that signal to travel up your leg and for your brain to register it. In terms of like overall human perception, our brains kind of trick us into thinking that things are happening instantaneously. But really, we've got like about 100 millisecond like window that in which we kind of cognitively perceive things as being simultaneous. But for a sensory system, for other aspects of our sensory system, our brains and owl brains are having to compute very very short time differences. So this poses a little bit of a biological challenge. The types of this isn't something that an owl is going to be able to do through some conscientious judgment of the time differences. Several years ago, back in the 50s, there was a cognitive scientist, Jeffress, who proposed a model for how a bunch of neurons might be able to do this type of a computation. And so the Jeffress model posits a relatively simple circuit where you have two neurons, a neuron that's kind of coming in from the left and a neuron that's coming in from the right. One of the things that neurons do with sound waves is they convert these sound waves into patterns of spiking activity. If you imagine it being like a barcode or like a Morse code of electrical activity that's traveling down a neuron. So you imagine this like this Morse code coming down one neuron from the left ear, or say for the right ear, and then that same pattern of activity coming from the left ear, and then you could have these coincidence detectors that fire off if they hear a signal at the same time. So in this model, if I've got something right in front of me, and if I've got sound coming into both ears at the same time, that sound gets converted into patterned activity in the brain. That patterned activity comes down the left and the right at the same time. The right ear activates this guy at the same time as the left ear activates this guy. Then they activate these ones. And then finally, at the middle, they both activate that that same neuron. And the idea is that these neurons in between are coincidence detectors. And so they are waiting for two to basically hear a signal from both of those other neurons before they say, like, okay, I heard something, and they fire off an electrical activity. The way I describe this is sort of like anthropomorphizing. It's like they hear this. But really, it's fundamental biological circuits, and it's fairly easy, and this is kind of one of the main things that neurons do, is they take in signals and electrical activity. That causes like local changes in the neuron. And then if that incoming activity meets some threshold or matches some pattern, then they can fire off. So it's you know, quite plausible as far as neural activity goes. And so in this scenario, I got auditory information coming into both ears at the same time. So this middle one is the one that fires off. And so that can, says like, you know, that's a reliable signal that the sound source was in front of me. On the other hand, if the sound source was off to the right, such that the pattern activity starts over here on the coming down the right side before it starts coming down the left side, then this will start marching over and activity will start coming in here before it starts coming in. And then it's these guys off here to the left that end up firing the same time, picking up that that coincidence detection. And so then these ones are indicators that my sound source was off to the left. And so by capturing that, and so this model was proposed back in the 50s, basically just as a, like, how might neurons be able to do this? Is it, given what we know about neurons, could we draw a circuit that does this computation? And that's what the Jeffers model was. So what about the actual Barnow? Like, what's actually happening inside the Barnow's head? Well, it turns out that there's a region in the Barnow brain that does almost exactly this. Technically two regions, kind of complementary on, because our brains are, we have left sides and right sides of our brains through most of it, and so it's actually kind of a, this mechanism is kind of doubled up. But basically, there is this area, NL, that does exactly this. So there are these fibers coming from this region called NM, either on the same side or on the opposite side of the brain. They converge into this area NL, and they have synapses onto individual neurons that basically end up calculating that exact time difference. And so these kind of more blue ones here versus these more blue-green ones here have response curves that look something like this. So if my time delay between my two ears is closer to zero, then these neurons in kind of this yellowish-greenish color are most likely to fire high, whereas the ones that are kind of on the delays are less likely to fire high. So these individual cells end up encoding those time differences. So then downstream, you know, those cells then are going and are then interacting with like the motor cells of the neck and such in order to help the animal to be able to converge and adjust accordingly. So what about us? We have to do basically this very, you know, similar tasks. We don't necessarily have quite the same acuity that that birds do. You can hear when a sound source moves. You can hear a car going by you. You can hear somebody talking over your shoulder. You can be in a in a room with a bunch of people chatting, and let yourself eavesdrop on that person over there instead of the person that you're facing and are talking to, right? And for humans, we actually, that scenario of like eavesdropping, we actually have an ability of being able to literally kind of focus our attention spatially as well. So, you know, what about us? What about other animals? You know, do we do the same thing? The short answer is no. So other birds do have a similar structure as the barn owl does. So the barn owl is here in the middle. So chickens have the same brain structures that the barn owl does, but with fewer neurons and much coarser resolution. So the basic structure that they use to do this like left-right computation is the same, but they don't have the same evolutionary pressures to hunt in the same way that that barn owls do. They do still, does anybody have chickens? Does anybody? We were one of those families that got a bunch of chickens during the pandemic. And they love bugs. Like they get obsessed and they just become these little dinosaur hunters when there's bugs around, and it's incredible. And I've no doubt that they are leveraging, you know, some of their brain like auditory behavior in order to zero in and grab those crickets or ants when they're hunting. But you know, they're nothing quite like the barn owl. Gerbils are a little bit more similar to humans. They have a totally different mechanism. They have a very large cell that has relatively slow dynamics and connectivity inside of it, where basically all this computation kind of happens in one cell. Geckos are super weird in that it's actually like an acoustic cavity inside of their mouth that causes differential pressure waves based on which side. If you imagine like a drum with two heads, that if one head gets hit first, it changes the acoustics inside. And that's how they end up being able to judge left and right differences. So the ways that different animals kind of do this type of computation is all over the place. But the owls have just a very super advanced part of their brain in order to zero in on this. Any questions about that?
Yes, I have one. How did they actually, the research, and that's probably a long question or an answer, but how did the research come up with that?
Yeah.
Did they dissect RL brains or other individual brains? And how did they know what they were looking for?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, over time, it's a combination of things. So what this is this is kind of like a drawing and a sketch. Of a slice through a particular region in the barn owl brain. I think it's the way that a lot of this work kind of plays out over time is one of the very first questions that neuroscientists will ask for a given animal is like, what's connected to what? Like, what are the brain regions? What are the areas? And so there's different ways of, this area NL has cell bodies in it. It also has fibers coming into it from different regions. So a researcher might euthanize an animal, dissect the brain, and have particular ways of placing dye in a certain part of that dissected brain, and then seeing like, okay, if I put dye over here, in this area, then to be able to actually see these neurons that go through and connect with that other area. So that's a first level like anatomy. And then once you're able to get like a sense of like what's the anatomy, what's connected to what, then it's possible to do neural recordings and record the activity of individual neurons while playing sounds on a speaker for an awake animal. Yeah.
What's the life expectancy of a barn owl, and does their hearing decrease as they age?
That's a great question. Yeah. I have no idea. I have no idea.
That would be at a huge loss.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talked about how they hear the different, like, left versus right, but how do they hear with, like, how do they hear so loud, I guess? How do they get that level of detail in, like, just, like, precision? Like, if I could hear a bug crawling on that wall, like, how do they do that part of
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So a big part of it is exactly what we talked about a little bit before. And I thought I had... Do I have those slides? Okay, I do. Yeah, so their facial feathers are literally a funnel. And so they have, in their face, they have three key types of feathers. Toward the middle of their face, they have these auricular feathers that are very, they're very light, they're very, very fluffy. They don't get in the way of sound very much. And then along the outside of that kind of like heart-shaped part of their face, they have these super specialized reflector feathers that do very literally create a funnel. And so that helps to maximize as much sound capture as they can get. So that's part of it. The other part is closely related to our next topic, which is elevation. Oh, I've got some more.
I have a quick question on that slide. Where are your ears actually at?
Yeah, I'll show you.
Yeah.
So their ears are, they have ears. They don't have pinnae that are quite as large as ours. They have smaller pinnae. They're just kind of hidden back behind the ruff. And so their ears are kind of like right around here-ish. Now I don't have a good example of the like a skull of a barn owl. Excuse me. But I do have a skull of this owl called a boreal owl. One of the reasons I like it is because these guys, it's really strongly emphasized. But partly, their ears kind of sit inside of these little caverns in their skull. Our skulls have holes for our ears as well, but they're kind of largely from the outside. Whereas the owls, it wraps around a little bit more. So the bone itself also helps to capture some of that sound too. What else do you notice about this guy? Yeah.
Like the eyes are really interesting looking.
Yeah, the eyes are. I mean, their eyes are really huge. One really interesting thing about owls is that they can't really move their eyes in their skull. So our eyes, we use our eyes extensively to move around and to look one place or another. I mean, primates in general do. For owls, their eyes barely move inside of their skulls, so they're largely fixed. One of the advantages that this has for them is that you can see this in the brain regions that support visual and auditory efforts. Is that they basically have a, well, I'll get into this in a minute, but because their eyes stay still, their acoustical environment and their visual environment overlaps. So they have to move their entire head in order to see something. So that, as they were going in to get that mouse, the way that it had its head, pointed out, so it was moving its entire field of vision and its field of hearing all together simultaneously.
They're always like, they're always looking at the same things.
They're always looking at the same thing that they hear. Whereas you and I, like, we can look over here, but then hear things over there, and our eyes can adjust, and we don't necessarily always maintain that same mapping.
Huh. Are their eyes bigger because they mostly eat during the day?
Actually the opposite. They mostly eat at night, which is why their eyes are so huge.
Yeah. So how does the quail owl in Hawaii, who eats during the day, how would they differ?
I don't know. Oh. I have no idea. What kind of owl is this?
Quail.
Well,
is the Hawaiian
quail
word.
Is the Hawaiian word for the
okay.
Owl.
Yeah, I don't know.
But they.
But it's a unique species to
the. Uh huh. Interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Are the ears in different places on the...
Yeah, so you can kind of see it here, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at, like, this from the note, like, this is a perfectly balanced image. And that right ear is clearing the heck up here, and the left ear is down there. That is not a deformation. That is an evolutionary adaptation.
I really want to pet it, because the skull looks so tiny, but then, like, it's there's so much, like, fluff around it. Like...
Yeah. Yeah. So, so that evolutionary adaptation does something really interesting. So we talked a lot about like differences in signals between the left and the right ear. And so for humans, we can largely use that left-right difference to judge the left-right, the differences in sound between our left and right ear to judge left and right acoustic activity. This asymmetry in the ear structure of owls means that they're able to pick up more elevation changes as well. Because now, the exact same trends that we were talking about in terms of differences in timing between the two ears, differences in amplitude between the two ears, that now occurs also for vertical changes as well. This gets... so the way that... so now, if we imagine... you know, you've got your owl that's listening for a mouse, and we have some, you know, two different stimuli that are happening between the left and the right. That change in ear positioning mostly changes the amplitude. It doesn't do a ton to the timing, but it mostly drives changes in the amplitude of how loud things are coming into the left and right ear. And so the way this manifests then is that if we imagine this circle is like the entirety of the acoustical space in front of them, such that sounds that are coming from the left would occur over here, sounds that are coming from the right would occur over here, sounds that are coming from above the head are up here, sounds that are coming from below the head are down here. What it means is that we have these contours of timing differences, such that if I have a 42 microsecond timing delay between the two ears, then that sound source is somewhere along this line. If I have a negative 126 microsecond delay, a delay in the other direction, then that's likely coming from this other direction. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then that's still a lot of ambiguity, right? That gives me like some sense of left and right, but I really don't have much information about up and down. My amplitude delays, though, start to then give me a lot of information about up and down. So if the volume is the same in both of my ears as a barn owl, then the location of the sound is somewhere along this line. If it's very quiet, if one ear it has a preference over the other, then it's either up above or down below. Mm-hmm. And so by combining this information, by combining the amplitude difference as well as the time difference, that gives the owl a fairly precise sense of its of the location of what it's going after in the 2D space in front of it. We talked a little bit about these feathers. These feathers also are incredibly important for getting this map right. So scientists can do a fairly simple experiment of pulling out feathers. So taking the owl, pulling out feathers, and then measuring, literally just putting little little microphones inside of the owl ears in order to pick up what they would be hearing, and then mapping this space, playing a bunch of speakers in different directions. This sketch right here is pulled from real data, but this is the actual data from some experiments. So with the Barnell's rough intact, oops, I'm about to run out of power. Sorry. Okay, crisis averted. So with the rough intact, the timing difference map looks something like this. Our level difference map looks something like this. And what I'd like to draw your attention to in particular is this area very close to the midline and how close together those lines are. So there's a lot of very strong ability to distinguish between the different level differences. With those reflector feathers around the outside removed, the timing differences between the two ears aren't compromised very much, but those level differences are. So those feathers really amplify and kind of work together with the shape of the bird's head in order to emphasize those level differences between the two ears. We talked a little bit about vision as well. In the Barnell brain, there is these areas that really is where a lot of this is encoded. The kind of the outputs of that area that I showed you before, the area that really maps on what the timing differences are between the left and the right, and that's this area called ICX. ICX is right adjacent to an area known as the optic tectum, which is where retinal input is coming from in the Barnell brain. And it's structured such that that locations in space are very closely mapped to auditory locations. So like visual locations and auditory locations are right next to each other. And so they interact with each other and they form a kind of a totality of the bird's experience. Researchers were able to experiment from several years ago that demonstrated that by putting glasses on the owls that had particular prisms, I remember when I was in doing some of these in like science fair projects and stuff. But it's basically glasses on the owl that shift their the spatial world off by like 20 degrees. So it's like if I'm looking forward, I'm actually like visual information from here feels like it's directly forward. Owls can adapt to this fairly quickly, and they can even, I think within a few days, like hunt successfully like this. And then by going in doing neural recordings, doing dissections, have identified that this part of the brain rewires itself in order to adjust.
That's so cool.
And so it rewires itself to make sure that the timing difference neurons that they've adjusted what their timing differences are to stay consistent with the visual field. So in summary, so our Barnells are primarily relying on timing differences to distinguish this left-right information, and they primarily rely on level differences to distinguish up-down location. This shape, this very unique shape of the bone around the ear, which pretty much all owls have, is asymmetrical, and it helps to improve up-down localization in barn owls. These facial rough feathers are critical, not just to like create a funnel and maximize the sound that comes in, but also to make these key localization cues more reliable. And finally, in the owls, their eyes don't move, and so their auditory world is very tightly locked with their visual world at a very fundamental neural level. And with that, thank you all very much for your time. I'll take any questions. Yeah.
What's the main motivation for people wanting to study all that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You mean like the like neural work?
Yeah.
A lot of it. So a lot of the work. So when I was one of my very first research projects was in sound localization. I was doing work with humans and human sound localization. One of the things that messes with humans a lot are echoes. So echoic environments become very challenging, especially if you have hearing loss, especially if you're dealing with hearing aids. You know, I made mention of this ability to like focus attention that humans can have, and that is. That can become more challenging, especially with age. A lot of the Barnow work that's being done is funded by the NIH to try to better support and understand fundamental neural mechanisms for human work as well. So most of it's funded by the NIDCD, the National Institute for Deafness and Communication Disorders. And you know, a lot of what it boils down to, you know, when we go back to to this type of a slide, is that all of these animals are fundamentally dealing with the same behavioral challenges, but by gaining a deeper understanding of these fundamental mechanisms, we're able to help to translate some of this work, hopefully into human work as well. Okay. Improve our cochlear implants, improve our hearing aid systems, improve these types of devices based on understanding fundamentals of the biology. Yeah. Yeah.
Like some owls, like I'm the one I'm thinking about, like the great horned owl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now they have a totally different face structure. And the other thing too that I was thinking is that I guess you said most owls have it. So actually, the tufts up here are not ears; they're something
right.
else.
Yeah.
How does there's facial differences there, and how does that? Has there been any research done on that in terms of how that kind of stuff works?
That's a really good question. I don't know much about that. My guess is that that it's probably fairly, in general, I would say that a lot of these animals they've evolved kind of tuned to their ecology and the environments in which they live. So I don't know what the details are, but I assume that. You know, owls that live in have different types of prey that they hunt, different types of environmental conditions that they're hunting in, that this is all going to change and put pressure on aspects of their facial shape and what types of like acoustic cues that their bodies are emphasizing. So, I think we had a question back here.
I would conclude, maybe this is wrong, but a minor injury to that area of the face could be life-threatening to the owl because they couldn't eat if they couldn't locate their food source.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I think one thing to keep in mind is that brains are brains adapt a lot. So I mean, I think this experiment I think is a really good example of this, that it's. Over fairly short order of an inconsistency between the visual field and the auditory field, that the brain adapted to that in order to meet those end goals. What types of plasticity brains can handle, what they can't, is kind of all over the place. But we have a lot of things that we aren't aware of and don't pay attention to for ourselves. So for example, our ear shape is really important for us and in this like up and down localization. So the shape of our ears, if you imagine like an equalizer settings on a stereo, imagine that you have a song and you like randomly jiggle your equalizer And then you take that same song and you randomly jiggle your equalizer again. You're going to be able to hear the differences between that. Those types of differences are the types of differences that we hear with stuff that's up above and down below us. We don't have a conscious awareness of this, but our brains can interpret that information and pick it up in order to localize it. So one of the things that I did when I was doing research in this area with humans is you can do some fancy computational tricks that can let I can design a virtual acoustic environment where and stick earbuds in your ears such that you are listening through somebody else's penne. And it will change, and it sounds super weird initially, but you can adjust to it, and you can adapt to it. People who have had injuries to their ears, you can mess with your. I remember I used to do this all the time when I was a kid, of moving my ears around, and start hearing this like shh sounds, like these like weird fuzzes that you don't normally hear. But your brain can adapt to that pretty quickly. So, yeah. Awesome. Great. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate your time.